You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Welcome to the Hot House. We're very proud of this tent. We think it's the prettiest tent on the Greenbelt campus. Isn't it lovely? And that's all thanks to the Pickwell Foundation. And there's information about the Pickwell Foundation over there, which I encourage you to go and read. But I love the decorations here. I love the fluffy clouds. I'm slightly worried about that seagull there that's been looking rather menacingly at me all week. And just to inform you that the decorations, particularly the trees and the Pickwell Foundation, have all come from Devon. And these trees were brought up just on Wednesday, and we saw them being pinned up there. And there's a Devon theme going, because our speaker at the next session, and she's on her own, not as billed in the programme, is also from Devon. And this is Sophie Pavel. And Sophie became well known in the kind of eco world for her first book, Forget Me Not, which some of you may well have read, which spurred a great deal of action against climate change and the loss of biodiversity. And she's at Greenbelt this time to talk about her new book, which is called To Have or To Hold. And she'll be talking about that in her speech, but it's also available in the G-Books afterwards, where Sophie will be at 12:30 to sign it. So please give a big Greenbelt welcome to Sophie Pavel.
Hello, everyone. Can everyone hear me okay? Yeah? Okay, cool. So, slight change of plan in that it's just me, unfortunately. For you, so I'm going to be freestyling this, if that's okay. But what I thought we'd do is, for the next kind of half an hour, 40 minutes, I'll have a little chat. I'll take you on a bit of a whirlwind tour. There we go. Perfect. Thank you. Bit of a whirlwind tour of my book, To Have or To Hold, with lots of readings, lots of storytelling, and then open up some questions at the end. What I'd really like to do, and I really enjoy doing this, is I'm really happy to take questions throughout. So if I say anything, or in a reading it kind of provokes a thought, or something you'd like to discuss or ask, please just put your hand up and I'd love to talk about it. There's a lot in this book. It's very full, with lots of new things and lots of food for thought, I hope. So I hope it will kind of get your brain whirring a little bit. But a bit about me, I'm from Devon. I was actually born in the States, but grew up in Exeter area and spent a very happy, adventurous childhood running around the moors and doing all sorts of fun things outside. And I think my love for nature was very much an experiential, visceral kind of thrill of the chase, as opposed to a very more traditional, I guess, search of birdsong and Latin names and identifying species. Mine's a bit more superficial than that, but I think more on a kind of very kind of passionate way of, I just love how nature makes me feel. And so that feeling, I think, really resonates with what I've gleaned so far in my very short time at this festival this morning. And the theme of the festival, Hope in the Making, I think resonates very much with my attitude towards the natural world. It's a very interesting time to be in science communication and the environmental sector at the moment. It certainly keeps us on our toes. But I definitely take a hopeful approach, and with that, this book especially, which is written around the traditional vow of marriage, of to have and to hold, the Western vow of marriage and togetherness. I wrote this book at a time where I was taking that vow myself in marriage, and it was a serendipitous, unintentional part of reshaping my view of nature and how we want to live alongside it and what our vow is as we progress in our journey as species on this planet. So, but then I added a little twist of uncertainty in there, because obviously we to have and to hold in the marriage ceremony in Christianity, but adding the or in there, I wanted to trip us up and ask, throw it into question. Do we want to have nature and exploit her and continue to take resources, or do we want to hold her close and live in a more symbiotic relationship with her? So that was my thinking for this book. I studied zoology at university. I've always been fascinated by the weird and wonderful strangeness of nature. I love the things that people hate. I love the grotesque side of nature. I love the violence of it, the kind of beautiful brutality that parasites show us, that the species who we can't see show us. And my mission is to try and help you see them from a new perspective. And so as much as this book is about species who live together in relationships that we may want to immediately consider as kind of cozy and mutually beneficial, it's actually a book about parasites and about nature's dark side and how that contributes to immense and vital stability across the natural world. And I will perhaps do some readings, I think. So, a lot of people have very kindly commented on the cover design of this book as being very striking. I can only take partial credit for that. All I did was provide a brief of I want something dark and psychedelic and kind of trippy. And Bloomsbury went away and had their way with it. And I'm so pleased with the result. And I thought maybe to begin, it might be nice to share an extract I wrote earlier this year, actually, before it was published in May, where it kind of came off the back of a conversation with a friend, and I sent her the cover design draft, and she said, yeah, it's great, but why the blue? Like, why are the colours weird? And I was like, well, actually, there's some thought behind it. So I thought maybe to get us in the mood, I'll share that with you. A note on the cover design. Studying symbiosis and nature's hidden relationships requires an elastic, inquiring mind, open to contradiction and dazzling possibility. When I began writing this book, I imagined its cover design as a high contrast, subverted composition of light, colour and creature, a visual that could guide us into the right headspace. Most ultraviolet light has a solar source, and many species emit visible light in the face of this ultraviolet light. What emerges from this collision is reflected fluorescence, rainbows of supernatural colour that can be seen across the natural world, but not by our eyes. When we witness this fluorescence revealed in ultraviolet photography, once familiar plants appear alien, tattooed with previously hidden patterns and guidelines. Floral body parts and paths to them are illuminated to help animals navigate to the plants they rely on. We too can choose to be directed by these hidden maps. They offer clues to the peculiar and unexpected ways that living organisms move through the world. And if we follow their lead, we can discover some of their unique and spectacular interactions. All species coexist within ancient entwined lives, and these relationships forge a legacy of survival. The vivid complexity of these relationships adds heat and light to this book's narrative, and I wanted to reflect that on its cover. I hope the beautiful cover visual created by designer Jasmine Parker prepares you for what you will read and allows you to glimpse our luminous world as nature does. So it was kind of a take on those photographs that you might see if you type into Google Images, like, what does a dandelion look like from a bee's perspective? And it is like mad. It's bright purple and yellow, and you see these hidden maps that guide them to the source of nectar. And so I thought it would encourage us to immediately shift our perspective and just open our minds to seeing nature in a slightly darker, more different, but more vital way than we perhaps have before. And I think befitting again of Greenbelt Festival, it again was unintentional, but a really grounding point for me to begin this book and my research into symbiosis, which is the study of the kind of spectacular situation of different species evolving to collide their lives, sometimes down to the DNA level for survival. And I began my journey in it, in the nave of Exeter Cathedral, where there was this amazing exhibition that was touring the country at the time. You may have seen it. It was called the Gaia Installation. And it was a, not to scale, obviously, but it was a model of planet Earth, completely spherical, suspended from the archways of the nave. And it invited onlookers to experience what's called the overview effect, which is what's reported by astronauts in the space station, for example, where regarding planet Earth from afar induces feelings of awe and wonder and this immense surge of protectiveness to love and cherish the planet that they're from and that they live on, and to return to Earth with a sense of care and yearning for restoration of the planet and the natural world. And that's what this exhibition did for me, and I think for many people. And it was a very humbling experience to have a moment to regard our planet in kind of its entirety within the nave of such a historic, special, sacred building. So that was kind of where I was at, and it helped me gather my thoughts and coalesce them around the Gaia model, the Gaia hypothesis, which was propelled by scientist James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis, both of whom I hold in massively high regard. I'm a big fan of both of their work. And they basically propose that Earth is one self-regulating, interconnected, completely dynamic system. And this is the board from which I spring to then go on these eight low carbon, tried to be self-powered as much as I could, around the British Isles in search of eight relationships that exist right here on our shores that are ancient, entwined, and entangled. And my main question throughout the whole book is, well, if nature has found a way to collide lives together for stability and sustainability and survival, what does climate change mean for them? Is it going to come in and break them apart? Is it the ultimate threat to this ancient relationship? Or might it change it in a way that could bring new participants onto the scene? And how might that disrupt ecosystem balance? And I was amazed that symbiosis is covered quite a bit in children's books. It's kind of a lovely introduction to the connectivity of the natural world, where you've got like the remora on the shark and it's cleaning the shark and the shark benefits the remora, gets some food. And then it's also studied in academia, which was my introduction to it, in modules of parasitology and social insect behavior and how fungi connects woodlands in this amazing way. But when I first started to really dig deep and finding that these relationships are absolutely everywhere, I couldn't believe that there weren't more nonfiction narratives on the subject, because I look at some of these relationships and immediately as a storyteller, I think, well, this is insane material. And it made me so excited to try and tackle it from my perspective and kind of bring a drop of femininity to it, maybe in a world that felt very masculine at the time. So I thought I'd read you a bit from the prologue to kind of introduce what symbiosis is. The funny thing is that I think a lot of us know what have come across the word symbiosis, but it's misinterpreted in many ways and misunderstood. And I think it will always be slightly misunderstood. And so I don't necessarily have an answer for how to define it, but this is my take on it. This tangle, this entwinement, this lively fusion of different lives is symbiosis. A lovely word, don't you think? Like the word Gaia, you may encounter myriad definitions of symbiosis, and you probably have an idea of its meaning. Maybe you have read descriptions of symbiosis that were presented to you using relatable human angles and connections. Sentences that include symbiosis often include words like mutualism and equality. Perhaps that's because those are the things we want in our relationships. When our relationships go well, we give, we receive. Is that why we want to believe relationships that work for us must also be good for nature? Except that isn't the case. The truth is nuanced and unruly. And so, before we begin, I kindly ask you to put all your preconceived notions and interpretations of symbiosis aside. You will find nature's variations of symbiotic relationships to be darker, far more shocking, and much more scandalous than you could imagine. In the name of survival, nature thrives on specific yet fluid relationships. Relationships as glamorous as they are grotesque and as bizarre as they are essential. Learning about some of them, we will see, know, experience nature at her best, brightest, and most raw. I've been told symbiosis is an art. In many ways it is, but when species have evolved to engage in these relationships, their life depends on it. For many, an elaborate, interdependent life having or holding on to one another is the only way to survive. So this kind of curiosity sparked the first of many of these trips. And the one that kind of was very much the epicenter of helping me grapple with this more nuanced, unruly understanding of symbiosis was to Jersey in the Channel Islands. Has anyone been to Jersey? Is anyone from Jersey, Channel Islands? Massively underrated part of the British Isles. I was completely enamored by it. And I pride myself, I think, from Forget-Me-Not, where I took 10 trips around the British Isles again, that I know the UK pretty well. I've been to some really cool parts of it. I've gone to the far-flung places that people don't seem to remember about. But the Channel Islands was new for me, and I was so taken by it. And it just so happens to be the home of a spectacular hybrid of a species that is neither plant nor animal. In fact, it's decided through evolutionary means, through symbiosis, to massively anthropomorphize and commit to massive scientific taboo, it has decided to become both. And this species is a worm. They're a flatworm. And without being a plant, this worm cannot move. It cannot feed itself. It cannot breathe. It cannot really be a thing. And it's just totally amazing for me. And so it goes by several names. The mint sauce worm, which is one of my favourites, because when you're walking, they sort of exist on the tide lines. So they kind of rise up from the sand with the retreating tide, and then they descend back into the sand with the incoming tide. And so if you walk out on the shores of Jersey or Guernsey as well at low tide, and you see this kind of nothing looking green mat that is so easy to just completely overlook, you look closer and you realize actually it's millions and millions, entire cities of worms moving and circulating in this fascinating hurricane-like swirl of a behavior called circular milling. They're very social creatures as well. They move together. And what they're doing is they're photosynthesizing. And they're just doing it day after day, year after year, and they have been doing it for millions of years. And it was such a reminder of how much we don't know about nature, how much there is to be beguiled by. And so I thought I'd read you a little extract of my journey to discover this species, as the lessons that we learn from this chapter very much assist our understanding and our further travels and explorations as we go further to Ireland and Scotland and all the other places. Can everyone hear me okay still? Yeah? Has anyone got any questions yet? Not, you don't have to. We can save them to the end. But feel very free to shout at me. Before I even began my travels to see a worm, this chapter went on quite the voyage. I still feel windswept from it. I plan to explore the interplay between the so-called slave maker ant and other wood ant species. Ants feature in the last chapter, by the way, so don't worry. If you're obsessed with ants, they get their turn. Perhaps you think spending time with a worm rather than a slave-making ant is a bit Hufflepuff versus Slytherin. Refund, please, you ask. But what if I told you this chapter will expose an oppressor of a different kind, an unsegmented, solar-powered kind, the kind with no heart, no blood supply, no excretory system, which somehow holds the secrets to regrowing their entire head and brain following a beheading and controlling cell growth to such a degree that they are turning heads across cancer research? Worms who can tolerate hours of UV radiation, sunlight, and near frozen water, but nobody knows how. Worms whose extraordinary bodies, barely 3 millimeters long, could revolutionize space travel. As soon as I heard about the plant-animal worm, I wanted them. I spent weeks obsessing over them, devouring every scrap of information I could find, like a jealous lover stalking their partner's ex. They wriggled in my dreams, and I went all scholarly and saw actual books on them. I interrupted conversations with friends to talk about them because they were always on the tip of my tongue, at the front of my mind. Well, these worms' strategy, their elaborate ruse to enslave, worked on me. I felt like a willing prisoner trapped in their mesh of muscle, waiting for them to have their way with me. And so what is fascinating about this worm is that I think it's in many ways become the springboard of a newer, more modern understanding of how species interact together. So I mentioned that symbiosis has traditionally been synonymous with words like mutualism and equality and kind of equal shares in the relationship. But there was this amazing study that came out in, I think it was 2016, that showed through studying species like these plant animal worms, which exist all over the world, people just don't really know that they're there because I guess they're small and therefore invisible to our eyes, but they're very, very much a part of many ecosystems across the world. They found that through studying them, through the algae being literally entrapped in the muscle fibers of this worm that are transparent so that when they're exposed to the sunlight, they can photosynthesize. And then the worm benefits from the byproducts of photosynthesis, the sugars, the starch, the oxygen. There are no equal shares in the relationship here. And the worms control the algae, control their proliferation, control the way that they organize themselves throughout the body of the worm to an almost abusive level. And that can feel quite a rude awakening, I think, to our understanding and our perception of nature. We want nature to be beautiful. We want nature to be neat and tidy. We want nature to be healing and peaceful and our sort of solace when times are difficult. And of course it is. And to me, it's even more so having a better understanding of it. But when survival is on the cards, nature will do nothing to try and achieve that. And I think through this study, it kind of catapulted a renewed look at parasites. So parasites are species who exert some level of suffering on another in order to survive and complete their own life cycle. And while this feels quite violent and challenging to accept at times, what it does is it promotes enormous ecosystem stability. So over half of all animal life thrive in a parasitic relationship, which says something about how successful that strategy is and how important it is. And I read an article when I was researching one of the other chapters for this. I think it was either the sunfish chapter or the hairworm. And it said that if we're considering even broaching a conversation of rewilding mammals to new locations, you know, we've probably all heard about beaver restoration. And I worked in beaver conservation for several years before this. And, now that people are talking about wolves and lynx. If we're talking about restoring species to new habitat or to their original habitats, we should also be restoring their parasites and their natural parasites. And it just... I think it just adds depth to the natural world that we don't have or that we're not offered to. And for me, symbiosis is a gateway to that and a really fascinating one as well. And the mint sauce worm is a real teacher in that, in how they kind of, how nature really does do her thing. So perhaps a happier chapter, although I think that's a very happy chapter. So this book has been out since May. And lots of people, it's always so gratifying as an author to hear from readers, because obviously you write a book in the hope that it will be read and spark thought and discussion. And the chapter that people, there are two chapters that people write to me most about. One of them is the sunfish and the other one is the hairworm. And we'll explore the hairworm after the sunfish. And I think maybe you'll see why they're like one extreme to the other. But the sunfish is, it was such a joy for me to write. They are the largest bony fish in the sea. Has anyone seen a sunfish before? Lucky you. Very good. They're incredible creatures. And they just so happen to be the most heavily burdened physically animal on earth with parasites. Parasites exist on or in every single organ of their huge body, which can be meters wide in diameter. And yet the sunfish survives and can live for decades and travels the world and is a circumnavigator of the world's oceans. And yet scientists dissect sunfish and experiments and find them to be unbelievably infested and colonized by up to 40,000 different kinds of parasite at any one time. How do they do it? How do they survive and reproduce? And yet they're almost this traveling circus of life, uniting nations of different species to the point where sunfish are relied upon by not only seabirds, but also reef fish at different points around the world for food, for snacks. So sunfish perform their iconic sunbathing behavior where they rise up to the surface from the deep. They can dive very, very deep and then rise up to the surface. And you may see, if you're on a boat trip in Cornwall, for example, which is what my adventure was to try and see them, seabirds will almost on cue come in and dive and, you know, extract these enormously long copepods and trematodes out from the gills of the sunfish, or sometimes even the eye. And it's a tasty protein snack. And the sunfish seems okay. And at the same time, you know, the sunfish might be in a Polynesian reef, for example, and there are species of fish who rely almost exclusively on a visiting sunfish to provide parasite protein snacks. So maybe think of that when you're next at the gym and you fancy a protein snack. But the sweet thing about sunfish is that they haven't perhaps got the publicity potential of the puffin or the beaver or the dolphin. And so they've largely been forgotten by conservation, and yet they've only recently been included on the red list. They are an enormously unfortunate victim of bycatch around the world, where they're swept up in fishing nets and discarded because they're of no use. They're not a commodity in many parts of the world, and yet they're the victim of that industry. But I'm going to read you a little bit about them now. Try and get you on board with Team Sunfish. The colour of a sunset, they are not. More stainless steel, robust and resistant to salt corrosion. No frills here. A sunfish's skin is not soft. It is rough and unscaled, highly unusual for a fish, and inscribed with countless character-building stories you wouldn't believe. I laughed upon seeing my first sunfish, the way they moved like a legless individual who has fallen into a river before swiftly realising that nothing about drowning is funny. The water on the port bow looked wrong, chopped up by a huge floppy dorsal fin that looked dislocated and distressed. I considered calling the Coast Guard. Next to bluefin tuna, marlin, shark or dolphin, a sunfish looks as unprepared for the sea as a dinghy without a sail. With mouths that remain permanently open and a look of horror, you'd be forgiven for thinking sunfish have been totally abandoned by evolution. And yet, the more their lives are untangled by science, the more science untangles other lives. For a start, sunfish bear one of the heaviest burdens of any living thing on Earth. At any one time, a single individual can be a vessel sustaining more than 40 different species of parasite. Oh, I said 40,000, I meant 40,000 individuals. 40 different species. Tiny organisms who require time on or in a sunfish to complete part of, or indeed all of, their life cycle. Such parasitic diversity is staggering for a single animal, a challenge for our brains to imagine, and of great interest to passing seabirds. Perhaps Jonathan Swift can help set the scene in his rather lovely, rather waffly, satirical 1733 poem, On Poetry, A Rhapsody. In it, he rightly pokes fun at humans for lacking the virtue, complexity, and sensibilities of the animal kingdom. So naturalists observe a flea, hath smaller fleas that on him prey, and these have smaller still to bite him, and so proceed ad infinitum. Thus every poet in his kind is bit by him that comes behind. The more we see nature, her lumps and bumps, the way she bites and snarls, her rise and fall, the more symbiosis becomes visible, ready to be experienced. Not one, no one, not even a poet, is exempt from having or holding infinite connections. As you read the next few pages, I ask you, and remind myself, to take comfort in seeing impossible weirdness, as in sunfish, as nothing but the greatest of gifts and talents. Because being confidently weird and in between is to have everyone underestimate you. So that's sunfish. And I promised you, before we turn over to a bit of Q&A, hairworm. Now, hairworms are probably one of my favourites because they're everyone's least favourite. And they are your archetype parasites. If you were to imagine a parasite, if I was to just sort of say, think of a parasite right now, they're sort of the theme that you might be thinking of. They are the ones that bury in the brains of others and get them to do unspeakable acts and have teeth and rows of projections that allow them to bury themselves in the brains of others. And they exist right here. And it's likely that you may have seen one before without realizing. So this chapter was an interesting challenge for me in many ways, because it allowed me to tackle the conversation about the health of our freshwater ecosystems, which is an ever-present, timely, urgent, terrifying issue. And it just so happens that this worm is an indicator of freshwater health. And so it's not just the salmon, it's not just the species who we can see on a day-to-day basis when we're going on a walk down by the river. It's a reminder of the invisibility of nature and its fragility. And if there is a river with hairworms in it, you're pretty sure, you can be fairly hopeful that that river's doing okay, because so many other species are involved in its very existence. So at the beginning of each chapter, I call the chapters weird names. For example, Sunfish was Misfits, and the Aspen chapter, when we're in the Cairngorms, is Killing Me Softly, which is all about death, but the possibilities of death and the hope in death in nature. And this chapter is called All Rise, and so I structure this chapter around an almost hypothetical court case of our relationship with the river, where we're sort of standing on trial as hairworm, as human, we don't really know, as to the way that we're treating freshwater. So it's a bit out there, but we'll see. But I also give each relationship a status, because I'm a millennial and I couldn't help myself. And I'm desperately trying to reach the sort of unreachable audiences with nature by trying to figure out what will hook their attention. And so I thought maybe this could be fun. And the relationship status of the hairworm is unhinged. Okay, so I'll just do a short reading here. Some call it suicide. Others call it homicide. There is a worm who has mastered the art of coaxing entirely new, alien, almost android behaviours from their host. With spellbinding precision, this worm moves through the bodies of others, be it arthropod or river, in a way that renders words insufficient. You cannot take your eyes off them, let alone your mind, and in this, the parasite has succeeded. Manipulation is dangerous, especially when it's conducted with such subterfuge that the intentions are concealed. Mental distortion creeps quietly over time like a cat in the shadows. It's not uncommon for victims of psychological exploitation in a relationship, be it romantic, professional, friendship, to feel emotionally asphyxiated, canalized, removed of all meander, submitting to their manipulator's desert of ethics and hunger for control. If this worm looked in a mirror, who would they see? So far, in our journey together, we have tumbled in waves of symbiosis with the confidence of at least knowing the participants of the relationship in question. We've ridden swells and crashed onto shore with the vigour of those who find comfort in knowing that life collides in chaos and colour and complexity, flirting with danger in the strangest of ways and bleakest of times. Because the emergency of survival and the drive to go on never falters. But this is an altogether different episode, a midway interruption, a dark jewel. Hold it up to the light, and what do you see? You see your face, fragmented by the cut of the edges. You see a reflection of something monstrous about our relationship as people with the natural world. You see the light bouncing off the facets like sunlight on the river. Look closer. A message. A warning. We're going to meet a parasite who will leave us at once fascinated and disgusted, because it's in our nature to be so. We should be grateful for this evolutionary gift when our gut can be wrenched while our mind stays riveted. Like this parasite's particular and exacting mode of manipulation, any gut reaction is a survival instinct. This parasite is a worm, one of Earth's ancient apostles, who looks like a strand of hair flinching in water as though possessed. Skilled in bodily espionage of specific arthropods, hairworms have adapted and concealed, blending into the society of freshwater habitats around the world. Through careful calculation, trial and error over millions of years, they've become master of another's mind through dastardly chemical and physical means, an accomplice to unspeakable acts. Are hairworms villains at work, or simply lives wishing to bury themselves within the brains of others and remain sly and unseen, blinkered in pursuit of surviving amid a dying landscape in the only way they know how? This will not be easy. My pen is forced by the fact that this relationship between parasite and host remains shrouded in mystery at my time of writing. In the British Isles, for example, their cyclone together eludes academics, biologists and ecologists into apology and puzzlement. And these are real emails I got from real, proper, grown-up academics. Unfortunately, I have absolutely no idea about these worms. Likewise, I haven't a clue about these worms. I'm afraid this is not something I work on. I've never seen this in action. I'm sorry, I don't know what to suggest. Really difficult to be categorically helpful here. This absence of certainty would be off-putting, daunting, even were I not floating under a strange hypnosis, pulled like a puppet by this parasite's charisma and volatility, tangled in their barbs, hooks, and spines. What may feel like stabs in the dark are in fact opening chinks through which light can drizzle. Because, at least for the British Isles, the chemistry between hairworm and host represents just one of the countless relationships that exist within and suggest healthy river ecosystems. Knowing them, even just a little, is one step closer to knowing our rivers and the wider habitat through which they run. Preserving host-parasite entanglement, however brutal and fantastical it may seem, helps to preserve the way of water. A hairworm's parasitic methods launch a bonus episode of our own record-breaking show. Despite being the longest-running show this world has ever seen, viewing figures are surprisingly low. It turns out not many of us want to tune in to our assault on freshwater. And I promise there's lots of light in the shade throughout the book. But I think what the hairworm allowed me to do, which I sort of drop gently, hopefully, throughout the book, is the question in the blurb is, are we the parasites of nature? But my argument is that actually we can learn a lot from parasites as to how to be a better parasite. So parasites exploit resources from their host, but they also practice restraint and immense sustainability because they only take what they need. And they never, if they kill their host, then their life cycle is broken and it's game over. So a parasite must keep the host alive and thriving to a point where some hosts, even though they go through massive ordeals of bodily espionage and kind of nervous system heists, they can reproduce and live on themselves once they expel the parasite. But then sometimes with the crab and the barnacle, when we go to Wales, they do that whilst the barnacle is kind of raiding them from within. And so I think when we're looking at our own relationship with the natural world and kind of what's next and where to go, I'm trying desperately to get people on kind of Team Parasite, because actually there's so many countless lessons that they can teach us about sustainability, about how to take resources, not in an extractive way, but in a way that is... it's called reciprocal exploitation. And I think if any of you has read the phenomenal Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, that was a hugely important resource book for me in terms of writing about these difficult subjects of connectivity and reciprocity and exploitation, but with a kind of warmth and a again, like a feminine tone. And she talks about the metaphor of marriage a lot in her book in terms of this give and take and this flux of resources, a kind of lively dynamic. And I think parasites demonstrate this beautifully. And so if you read the book, I'd encourage you to take it at a slow pace and keep an open mind. And I think with that, I'd love to turn over to any questions. And thank you for listening.
Okay, I have a very long lead on this microphone. I'll try to get to you without garrotting anybody on the way. So any of Team Parasite want to ask questions? Shall I come over to you first? And I know yesterday I was running around all over the place. Try and get a group of people over here would be useful if I come to that lady there. Yeah.
Hi, Sophie. I would just like to ask, how is your research changing the ways that you want to live your life?
Very good question. How is my research changing the ways I want to live my life? Well, writing a book like this required a grim amount of research. And I was very lucky in that to help assist me with my understanding and my travels and the sort of narrative as a whole, I include the voices of many experts throughout the book to add credibility, which was very questioned when I set out to tackle this very complex topic. And I think the word that sprung to mind as you asked that question was intention. And I think I had to be very intentional about my research because, you know, talking about even glossing over or musing concepts like exploitation and manipulation and control can lead you down very grim, dark alleys of human history and current history, living history. And I had to, like a parasite, exercise restraint there. And my intention was to open the door of symbiosis and collectivity from a perspective that perhaps you haven't encountered before, and to basically reintroduce you to that topic through the stories of eight relationships. And so that had to be very intentional. And I think since then, and this book I think still has its talons in me a little bit, it was a very kind of all-consuming process, living intentionally with the natural world and in my own relationships. And I did a lot of reflection on my own relationships and my relationship with nature whilst writing this. And I think if anything, it's just encouraged me to hold it even closer and to realize the fragility in amongst all the strength of these things. There's immense fragility and precariousness. And so I think moving about the living world and the natural world and with each other, and this festival again is an incredible example of this, with intention, I think can add a lot of depth and richness to our experience on this planet. I hope that answers your question. I don't know. Thank you.
Hi, Sophie.
Hello.
I just wonder, I'd love to hear some reflections about how what you've learned about parasites in the non-human natural world. Well, the question I have is, what about human parasites that we're trying so hard to get rid of, like malaria, guinea worm, that cause a lot of suffering? Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, so parasites are very good at what they do. There's a reason why they're so dominant in the natural world, and it's the dominant form of how life knits together. And unfortunately, there are parasites that are incredibly harmful. And, you know, when I mentioned that article that talked about if you're going to rewild mammals, you may as well, it's vital to rewild them with their natural parasites, the emphasis being on their natural parasites, because parasites in the wrong place at the wrong time can wreak havoc. And I think historically, parasites have been an effective population control because nature thrives on a carrying capacity, which is a sustainable number of living things that will ensure resources are still plentiful and adequate and things are surviving well and achieving their lifespan. But the trouble is that with, you know, modern humanity and globalization and international travel and more people and people demanding more and more of the planet, suddenly things are turning up in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so I guess my only real answer or thought there is that I think when parasites start becoming a problem, it's symptomatic of, again, how we're going about using the planet, using and abusing the planet, because if they're going above and beyond their sort of natural impact on the planet, as in causing epidemics and pandemics, which are natural and they always have been, always will be. But I think, again, it's an encouragement for us to look inward maybe as to how we can mitigate against those so that parasites offer us more resilience than harm. But yeah, human parasites are not really my field of expertise, but happily we are host to about 400 different species of parasites. So we would not be sat here functioning, living, breathing without parasites. So if your journey can begin with that level of engagement, then that's a good thing, maybe. Thank you.
Hi, Sophie. You said at the beginning that part of the impetus for your for this book was to investigate how the parasitic relationship was being affected by climate change. And I just wondered what you discovered.
Oh, yeah, I forgot to say that. well, so as ever, it's very complicated and it's something that is unfolding. Don't know all the answers yet, but for example, with the sunfish, I mentioned they sort of circumnavigate the globe and turn up in the wrong place. Turn up in all sorts of places. And what they're finding is quite, it's fascinating, but quite disturbing in a way, is that drought in the Mediterranean is affecting the nutrients that flow out into the sea, which is affecting the nutrients available for the base of the marine food chain, like zooplankton, phytoplankton, which form the basis of the diet for a sunfish. So a sunfish wants to be eating like jellyfish, zooplankton, copepods, like all the kind of small things, and they need to eat a lot of them. And what was really striking for me is that I'd never really thought about how drought on land can affect the deep pelagic open ocean. And it really is. And the trouble is that with this loss of summer nutrients not flowing into the sea, species are getting smaller. And this is being found across the world, that marine species and fish are actually shrinking with climate change. And it's not only drought that's a propelling factor there, it's these really devastating marine heat waves that we've been seeing the last couple of years. So warming ocean temperatures, ocean acidification, carbon dioxide dissolving into the ocean water and acidifying it. And so in terms of what will happen to a species like sunfish, which is happily one of the largest, was the largest bony fish in the world, it is naturally a giant. What does this threat of shrinking species mean for an ocean giant? And when you have a species that is relied upon by, let's say, 40,000 parasites at any one time in its body, that is relied upon by seabirds or other species around the world, that domino effect of impact can be really interesting. But then going back to the hairworm as well, they're finding that the way that a hairworm can navigate when it's in the brain of, say, a cricket, which is their final host, it needs to instruct a walk back to water so that the cricket can leap into the water and then the hairworm exits from the head. You can Google it, it's mad. But what they found is that this walk, this zombie walk led by the hairworm in the brain of the host, happens at night. And so how can they navigate back to water? And the hunch is, the current thinking is, and I spent time with a research group at Bath University on this, and they're still trying to figure it out. But their current thinking is that they use celestial cues, so reflected moonlight off of water, providing enough of a guide, a compass, for the hairworm inside the host to find water. But the trouble is that 80% of the world lives under anthropogenic man-made light, and also noise. So species like cricket rely on noise and make their famous song in order to find mates. And so if cricket's breeding themselves, you know, as an entity, is affected by a world that is noisy. I think 60% of Europe has a background noise that's the same level as constant rainfall in terms of traffic, construction, dogs. And so what they're finding is that this just effectively serves to separate host from parasite. And when a hairworm relies on the bodies of up to 5 different species to complete its life cycle, again, that's more than one species affected by something. And so there are examples of severance and kind of effectively divorce of host from parasite, which are seen across the world. Parasites can't find their host and hosts can't find other members to create their own population. But then there are some cases where different organisms are suddenly coming into the relationship and happening upon the scene. And so, it's a difficult one. But climate change is certainly, I think, ruffling the feathers of these very established relationships.
Okay, so a question. Thank you. Hello, I got a really strange question. For within the genetics, for example, genetics of like disabled, deaf people. I know that genetics is passed on with human beings. I'm wanting to know really about, is those similar genetics, disability genetics, passed on through other creatures? And has that ever been researched? Do you know anything about that?
Oh, that's a really great question, but I can't say that I can answer that. I don't know the, I can't, I don't have any research to draw upon there. I'm so sorry. Thank you, though. Genetics is not my area of expertise. It always made me feel a bit sick at university. Maybe someone else here can answer that.
Hiya.
Hello.
With your analogy of comparing humans as parasites, which like it took me aback for a moment, but then I sat with it and I was like, oh my God.
Not necessarily a bad thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Did you do any research on maybe indigenous peoples and how they live with the environment? Would you say that they're a rather good example of parasitical relationships because they're usually in like a subsistence economy? Mm-hmm. They work with the nature. They even help it thrive.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on that?
Well, you've kind of answered the question beautifully there yourself. I mean, there was a point where I really wanted to, I was at a crossroads where I wanted to either go into doing almost a separate chapter on how indigenous cultures view symbiosis and how they practice it, and it's almost so ingrained in their society. But then I had to, again, practice restraint and keep to the brief, which was to almost take a step back and work on the beginning of this wider story of symbiosis, which is let's see how nature does it first. But certainly when I was reading Robert Moore Kimmerer's work and then speaking to other people who and reading about other cultures around the world, particularly Native Americans, to be honest. And I'm from North America, and so I guess I'm slightly biased towards finding resources and publications that speak about those cultures. But they practice restraint and they take what they need and they exercise reciprocity with the land. And again, going back to Robin's work, you know, she writes so movingly about thanking the earth for the food that it has provided and grown for her and nourished her. And I think that act of leveling yourself in an act of humility as just seeing yourself as part of nature and taking nature's offerings with gratitude and with acceptance and intention, I think is such a powerful model for how we can move through nature. And I just wish that those lessons would reach the ears of those people who are able to make mass change in order for that to be a bit more of a way of living. But, you know, I think something is, we can learn a lot from the act of growing plants and vegetables and knowing where our food comes from, and that provenance can also be a massive act of reconnecting with the earth in a way that feels a lot more emotional. And I think it's getting better, but the scientific community could perhaps be set a better example for welcoming emotion into these conversations. But I think it's definitely moving towards that thing. But I think that very emotional human act of grounding yourself with the planet that indigenous cultures do so well is a lesson for us all. Thanks for your question. Hello.
Hello. I'm interested in the taming of animals or the taming of people. And is that a similar process to the parasites and hosts?
So do you mean from like a domestication point of view?
Yes, wolves taming men or women, or the other way round.
Yeah. I guess the word that sprang to mind there for me was control. So parasites do exert a level of control to get what they want from a host and a level of cunning and precision. And again, that's where the sort of metaphor extends for me and the parallels align, because humans are experts at exerting control and getting what they want. And so I think there's a level there. But again, parasites know when to stop, because their survival depends on it. Otherwise, they'll kill their host. And so I think that's the lesson that I drew from when I found that. Thank you.
Someone who is celebrating their 45th wedding anniversary today.
Oh,
I'm very interested in the marriage analogy that you had, yeah. But I'm more interested actually knowing what your, when you mentioned about having a feminist approach to some of this work, can you just tell us a little bit more what that approach is? What difference did it make?
Oh, thank you. That's a lovely question. So taking a more feminine approach was kind of an act of defiance at first, because some of the experts that I approached to ask for help on this were very skeptical about my reasoning for tackling a topic like symbiosis. You know, where was my PhD? Where were my peer-reviewed papers? I think over Zoom especially, I just looked like a silly little girl who was wanting to write a lovely book about something. And so I wanted, it was a kind of, you know, they, one in particular very much advised caution against doing this topic and asked to review my work. And I sort of said, no, that's what I've got a publisher for, actually, thanks. So you're fine. So it kind of lit a fire in my belly to sort of tackle what felt still like a very masculine topic, despite the fact that Lynn Margulis, of course, who was an amazing scientist in the 50s, 60s, and unfortunately died several years ago, proponent of this, and she was a force of nature. So I had Lynn kind of in my mind as my guiding light there in terms of how she tackled these difficult topics in a male-dominated space. But also going back to Gaia, Gaia is Mother Earth, translates to the sort of Greek goddess of the planet and of Earth. And the more I sort of researched that, the more it just felt completely instinctive for it to take a kind of feminine approach. And I then also committed another scientific taboo, which the Times Literary Supplement did not like, which was hooing nature and using a grammar of animacy to talk about species. And my background's in zoology, I have a master's in science, never once was this acceptable. And yet I feel like we're at a really exciting turning point, thanks to the likes of Rob McFarlane and Is a River Alive and other voices in this space, where connecting to nature through language is so possible and powerful. And I think, again, seeing ourselves as just part of nature and referring to species as her or she or they or who instead of it, involves ourselves in that story, which I think is so cool and exciting. And so I really enjoyed doing that. And I think writing it in the year that wasn't planned, but writing it in the year that I got married as well. And I guess I was having those kind of conversations with friends and family and reflecting on my own relationships and looking at relationships that I admired. I think the femininity felt natural. I guess I felt like I was reaching a point in my journey as a young woman that I sort of felt a bit more of my own power there, maybe, but I'm still searching for that. But it just felt fun to kind of, science says one thing and I was like, nope, I'm gonna do it the other way.
Okay, so I think we'll probably draw to a close there. Before I thank Sophie, could you give a round of applause to our wonderful translators here, please? Thanks so much, and thanks for all you do in other tents as well. For those of you who thought Mike Berners-Lee was going to be here, he is at Greenbelt, and he will be, I think, in this tent later on today. He wanted to concentrate on his own session. But please, will you join me in thanking Sophie? This is her first Greenbelt ever, so give her an extra round of applause, please. And do join her for the book signing, which is at 12:30 in the G tent, where yes, she'll be happy to sign your copies.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.